Death of the Marquis of Hastings.
Oh, yes, sir. 2:15 to be quite exact, sir. And no other way to be, as we're on the Colton Maxwell system of patent punch clocks. Just a sort of dripping sound, sir. For a moment I took it to be a leakage, forgetting the night was clear. Rain, I thought, and that was all my anxiety, sir, thinking the land leviathan would be damaged by damp, so I flung my lantern's beam up quick, and there the poor rascal hung, and blood all down the leviathan's neck bones, sir, and all on the, what do you call them, the armatures what hold the beast upright, and his head a bloody ruin, sir, no longer as you'd call a head at all, dangling there by his ankles from this manner of harness, and I saw the ropes and pulleys going straight up taut into the dark of the great dome, and the sight struck me so, sir, that it wasn't till I'd sounded the alarm that I saw the leviathan's head was missing too. Yes, sir, I do believe that to be the case, the manner in which it was done. He was lowered down from the dome and did the job up there in the dark and paused when he'd hear my footsteps and then continue his work, the work of some hours, for they'd had to rig their lines and pulleys. Likely I passed beneath them several times on my watch, and when he'd got it free, the head, sir, someone else winched it up and took it away through that panel they'd unbolted. But something must have given, sir, or slipped, for down he came, square into the floor, best Florentine marble, that is. We found where his brains had been dashed, sir, though I'd as soon forget it. And I did then recall a sound, sir, likely of him striking, but no outcry. If I may say, sir, what strikes me as vilest in the whole business might be the cool way they hauled him back up, quiet as spiders, and left him slung there, like a coney in a butcher's window, and stole away across the rooftop with their booty. There's a deal of meanness in that, isn't there?
Kenneth Reynolds, Night Watchman, the Museum of Practical Geology, in deposition before Magistrate G.H.S. Peters, Bow Street, November 1855. Believe me always.
My dear Egremont, I write to you to express my profound regret that the circumstances of the moment should deprive me of the opportunity and hope of enlisting your great capacity in the further service of party and government. You will well understand that my recognition of your difficult personal circumstances is absolutely separate from any want of confidence in you as a statesman. This is the last idea I should wish to convey. How can I close without fervently expressing to you my desire that there may be reserved for you a place of permanent public distinction? Believe me always, yours sincerely, I. K. Brunel.
Ministerial Letter to Charles Egremont, M.P., December 1855. Memorandum to the Foreign Office.
On this occasion, our distinguished guest, the ex-president of the American Union, Mr. Clement L. Vallandigham, got as drunk as a fiddle. The eminent Democrat showed that he could be as profligate as any English lord. He fumbled Mrs. A., kissed the shrieking Miss B., pinched the plump Mrs. C., black and blue, and ran at Miss D. with flagrant intent to ravish her. Finally, after throwing our female guests into hysterics by behaving like an elephant in must, the noble beast was captured by main force and carried upstairs, all 4 feet in the air, by our household staff. Within his room, Mrs. Vallandigham was awaiting him in shift and mob cap. There and then, to our considerable amazement, this remarkable man satiated his baffled lust on the unresisting body of his legitimate spouse, and copiously vomited during the operation. Those who have seen Mrs. Vallandigham would not think this latter incredible. News has now reached me that the former president of Texas, Samuel Houston, has died in Veracruz, in his Mexican exile. He was, I believe, awaiting any call to arms that might have brought him back to eminence, but the French alcalde were likely too wily for him. Houston had his faults, I know, but he was easily worth 10 of Clement Vallandigham, who made a shrinking peace with the Confederacy and has allowed the vultures of red Manhattan communism to gnaw the carcass of his dishonoured country.
Lord Liston, 1870.
Before the Rads. The following testament is a sound recording inscribed on wax. One of the earliest such recordings, it preserves the spoken reminiscences of Thomas Towler, born 1790, grandfather of Edward Towler, inventor of the Towler audiograph. Despite the experimental nature of the apparatus employed, the recording is of exceptional clarity. 1875.
I remember one winter, and it was a very long, cold winter, and there was dire poverty in England then, before the rads. My brother Albert, he used to get some bricks and cover them with bird lime, and set them by the stables to catch sparrows. And he'd pluck them, clean them, him and me together. I helped him. Our Albert would make a fire and get the oven hot, and we used to cook those little sparrows in mother's roasting tin, with a big lump of dripping in it. And my mother would make a big jug of tea for us, and we'd have what we call a tea party, eating those sparrows. My father, he went to all the shopkeepers on Chatwin Road and got scrap meat. Bones, you know, lamb bones, all sorts of things. Dried peas, beans, and leftover carrots and turnips. And he got some oatmeal promised him, and a baker gave him stale bread. My father had a big iron boiler that he used to make gruel for the horses, and he cleaned it all out, and they made soup in this big horse boiler. I can remember seeing the poor people come. They came twice a week that winter. They had to bring their own jugs. They was that hungry before the rads. And, Eddie, did you ever hear tell of the Irish famine in the '40s? I thought not. But the tater crop failed them, too, 3 years in a row, and it looked mighty dire for the Irish. But the rads, they wouldn't stand for that, and declared an emergency, and mobilised the nation. Lord Byron made a fine speech, in all the papers. I signed aboard one of the relief boats, out of Bristol. All day, all night, we'd load big gantry crates with bills of lading from the London engines. Trains come day and night from all over England with every kind of food. God bless Lord Babbage, the poor Irish would cry to us with tears in their eyes. Three cheers for England and the rad lords. They have long memories, our own loyal Irish. They don't never forget a kindness.
John Keats, in Half Moon Street. I was ushered by a manservant into Mr. Oliphant's study. Mr. Oliphant greeted me cordially and noted that my telegram had mentioned my association with Dr. Mallory. I told Mr. Oliphant that it had been my pleasure to accompany Dr. Mallory's triumphant lecture on the Brontosaurus with a highly advanced kinotropic program. The monthly review of the Steam Intellect Society had run a most gratifying review of my efforts, and I offered Mr. Oliphant a copy of the magazine. He glanced within it, but it seemed that his grasp of the intricacies of clacking was amateurish at best, for his reaction was one of polite puzzlement. I then informed him that Dr. Mallory had led me to his door. In one of our private conversations, the great savant had seen fit to tell me of Mr. Oliphant's daring proposal to employ the engines of the police in the scientific exploration of previously hidden patterns underlying the movements and occupations of the metropolitan population. My admiration for this bold scheme had brought me directly to Mr. Oliphant, and I stated my willingness to assist in the implementation of that vision. He interrupted me, then, in a markedly distracted manner. "We are numbered," he declared, "each of us by an all-seeing eye. Our minutes, too, are numbered, and each hair upon our heads. And surely it was God's will that the computational powers of the engine be brought to bear upon the great commonality, upon the flows of traffic, of commerce, the tidal actions of crowds, upon the infinitely divisible texture of his work." I waited for a conclusion to this extraordinary outburst, but Mr. Oliphant seemed quite lost in thought of a sudden. I then explained to him as nearly as possible in layman's terms how the nature of the human eye necessitates in kinotropy both remarkable speed and remarkable complexity. For this reason, I concluded, we kinotropists must be numbered among Britain's most adept programmers of enginery of any sort, and virtually all advances in the compression of data have originated as kinotropic applications. At this point he interrupted again, asking if I had indeed said the compression of data, and was I familiar with the term algorithmic compression. I assured him that I was. He rose, then, and going to a bureau near at hand, he brought out what I took to be a wooden box of the sort used to transport scientific instruments, though this was partially covered, it seemed, with remnants of white plaster.
and would I be so kind, he requested, as to examine the cards within, copy them for safekeeping, and privately report to him upon the nature of their content. He had no idea of their astonishing import, you see. No idea whatever.
John Keats, quoted in an interview conducted by H.S. Lywood for the Monthly Review of the Steam Intellect Society, May 1857. The Grand Panmelodium Polka. Oh, sure, the world is all run mad, the lean, the fat, the old, the rad, all swear such pleasure they ne'er had as the Grand Panmelodium Polka. First cock up your right leg so, balance on your left great toe, stamp your heels and off you go, the Grand Panmelodium Polka. Quadrilles and waltzes all give way, machine-made music bears the sway. The chimney sweeps on the 1st of May, in London dance the polka. If a pretty girl you meet, with sparkling eyes and rosy cheek, she'll say, young man, we'll have a treat if you can dance the polka. Professors swarm in every street to hear the Panmelodium sweet, and every friend you chance to meet asks if you dance the polka. And so to the roadie-do we dance, and in short skirts and brass heels prance. Ladies, won't you spare a glance for the boys what spin the polka?
The Tatler.
We learn with mingled regret and amazement of the recent departure, aboard the Great Eastern, of the well-liked and many-talented Mr. Lawrence Oliphant, author, journalist, diplomat, geographer, and friend of the royal family, for America, with a stated intention of residing in the so-called Susquehanna Phalanstery, established by Messrs. Coleridge and Wordsworth, thereby to pursue the utopian doctrines espoused by these worthy expatriates. Round Town, a column, September 12, 1860. A London Playbill, 1866. The Garrick Theatre, Whitechapel, newly rebuilt and refurbished, under the management of J.J. Tobias, Esquire, presents The First Nights of a New Kinotropic Drama, Monday, November 13th, and during the week. The performance will commence with First Time, an entirely new national, local, characteristic, metropolitan, melodramatic, kinotropic drama of the day, in 5 acts, correctly exhibiting modern life and manners in innumerable novel and interesting phases, called the Crossroads of Life, or The Clackers of London. The groundwork of the drama, founded on the celebrated play Les Filles de Vaucanson, now attracting the attention of all France, and applied to the circumstances and realities of the present moment. With kinotropic scenery by Mr. J.J. Tobias and assistants. The new flash medley orchestra led by Mr. Montgomery. The action of the piece arranged by Mr. C.J. Smith. The dresses by Mrs. Hampton and Miss Bailey. The whole produced under the direction of Mr. J.J. Tobias. Dramatis Personae. Mark Ridley, alias Fox Skinner, a swell cove and king of the London Clackers, Mr. H. L. Marston. Mr. Dorrington, a wealthy Liverpool merchant on a visit to London, Mr. J. Romer. Frank Danvers, a British naval officer just arrived from the Indies, Mr. W. M. Bird. Robert Danvers, his younger brother, a ruined roué pigeoned by the Clackers, Mr. L. Melvin. Mr. Hawksworth Shabner, principal proprietor of a West End clacking hall, bill discounter, and anything Aryan where there is anything to be got, Mr. P. Williams. Bob Yorkner, a duffer, tired of the lay, Mr. W. Jones. Ned Brindle, the magsman, a half-and-half cove, Mr. C. Aubrey. Tom Fogg, alias Old Deadly, alias The Animal, a laudanum fiend suffering under delirium tremens, Mr. A. Corino. Joe Onion, alias The Crocodile, a bully rock and creature of Shabner's, Mr. G. Belasco. Dickie Smith, the wakeful bird, a young engine clerk in no ways particular, pecking out a living as best he can, Mr. G. Maskell. Ikey Bates, landlord of Rat's Castle, proprietor of Twopenny Dabs and a scandalous bagatelle board, having cut the bumble puppy as too low, Mr. Gotobed. Waiter at the Cat and Bagpipes Tavern, Mr. Smithson. The Bow Street Special Investigator, Mr. Franks. Louisa Trueheart, the victim of an ill-requited attachment, Miss Caroline Barnett. Charlotte Willers, a young lady with her cat from the country, Miss Martha Wells. Dress circle 3 shillings, boxes 2 shillings, pit 5 pence, gallery 2 pence, Box office open daily from 10 o'clock until 5. A Poem of Farewell. Mori Yujo, a samurai and classical scholar of Satsuma Province, wrote the following ceremonial poem upon his son's departure for England in 1854. It is translated from Sinicized Japanese. My child rides the unfathomable deep, in pursuit of noble ambition. Far must he sail, 10,000 leagues, outpacing the breezes of spring. Some say that east and west have naught in common, but I say the same heaven overarches both. His own life he risks on command of his Han, braving great danger to learn from far places. For family's sake he spares no effort, seeking for wisdom in face of great hardship. He travels far beyond the fabled rivers of China. His scholarly labours shall some day bear fruit in splendid achievement. A Letter Home. As always, I searched that day for land in all four directions, but could still find none. How melancholy it was! Then by chance, with the captain's permission, I climbed up one of the masts. From the great height, with sails and smokestack far below me, I was amazed to make out the coast of Europe, a mere hair's breadth of green above the watery horizon. I shouted down to Matsumura, "Come up, come up!" And up he came, very swiftly and bravely. Together, atop the mast, we gazed upon Europe. "Look," I told him, "here is our first proof that the world is really round." While we were standing down there on deck, we could not see a thing. But up here, land is distinctly visible. This is proof that the surface of the sea is curved. And if the sea is curved, why, then, so is the whole earth. Matsumura exclaimed, "It's fantastic! It's just the way you say. The earth indeed is round. Our first real proof." Mori Arinori, 1854. Modus. It seemed that her ladyship had been ill-served by the Paris publicists, for the lecture hall, modest as it was less than half-filled. Dark folding seats in neat columnar rows were precisely dotted by the shiny pates of balding mathematicians. Here and there among the savants sat shifty-eyed French clackers in middle age, the summer linen of their too elegant finery looking rather past the mode. The last three rows were filled by Parisian women's club, fanning themselves in the summer heat and chattering quite audibly, for they had long since lost the thread of her ladyship's discourse. Lady Ada Byron turned a page, touched a gloved finger to her bifocal pince-nez. For some minutes a large green bottlefly had been circling her podium. Now it broke the intricacy of its looping flight to alight on the bulging archipelago of her ladyship's padded, lace-trimmed shoulder. Lady Ada took no apparent notice of the attentions of this energetic vermin, but continued on gamely, in her accented French. The mother said, "Our lives would be greatly clarified if human discourse could be interpreted as the exfoliation of a deeper formal system. One would no longer need ponder the grave ambiguities of human speech, but could judge the validity of any sentence by reference to a fixed and finitely describable set of rules and axioms. It was the dream of Leibniz to find such a system, the Characteristica Universalis. And yet the execution of the so-called modus program demonstrated that any formal system must be both incomplete and unable to establish its own consistency. There is no finite mathematical way to express the property of truth. The transfinite nature of the Byron conjectures were the ruination of the Grand Napoleon. The modus program initiated a series of nested loops which, though difficult to establish, were yet more difficult to extinguish. The program ran, yet rendered its engine useless. It was indeed a painful lesson in the halting abilities of even our finest ordinateurs. Yet I do believe, and must assert most strongly, that the modus technique of self-referentiality will some day form the bedrock of a genuinely transcendent meta-system of calculatory mathematics. The modus has proven my conjectures, but their practical exfoliation awaits an engine of vast capacity, one capable of iterations of untold sophistication and complexity. Is it not strange that we mere mortals can talk about a concept, truth, that is infinitely complicated? And yet, Is not a closed system the essence of the mechanical, the unthinking? And is not an open system the very definition of the organic, of life and thought? If we envision the entire system of mathematics as a great engine for proving theorems, then we must say, through the agency of the modus, that such an engine lives, and could indeed prove its own life should it develop the capacity to look upon itself. The lens for such a self-examination is of a nature not yet known to us, yet we know that it exists, for we ourselves possess it. As thinking beings, we may envision the universe, though we have no finite way to sum it up. The term universe is not in fact a rational concept, though it is something of such utter immediacy that no thinking creature can escape a pressing knowledge of it, and indeed an urge to know its workings, and the nature of one's own origin within it. In his final years, the great Lord Babbage, impatient of the limits of steam power, sought to harness the lightning in the cause of calculation. His elaborate system of resistors and capacitors, while demonstrative of the most brilliant genius, remains fragmentary and is yet to be constructed. Indeed, it is often mocked by the undiscerning as an old man's hobby horse. But history shall prove its judge, and then, I profoundly hope, my own conjectures will transcend the limits of abstract concept and enter the living world.